They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
There is an economic quiz to start. Nothing too tough, I promise. Also, oil and, unrelated, traffic jams in Los Angeles. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, April the 24th. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. So look, here is what I'm going to do. I'm going to list a couple of right now economic realities. You think about whether they are, generally speaking, of course, good or bad. Number one, rising interest rates, as we have been telling you about lately. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note hit 3% today for the first time in more than 4 years. Number two, rising oil prices. The U.S. benchmark is headed towards $70 a barrel, $70 a barrel, again for the first time in 4 years. Home prices are up more than 6% in February from a year ago, according to the oft-cited Case-Shiller Index. I'm going to give away the game a little bit here and tell you that those are all signs of an economy that is growing quite nicely, thank you, and they are all generally good things in an economy where workers' wages are going up commensurately. And that is where this story takes a turn, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Gas prices are near a three-year high. Home prices have risen for 70 months straight, even as the cost of borrowing goes up. All perfectly normal, says economist Nariman Baravesh at IHS Market.
Higher prices are one of the consequences of a strong economy.
There are other factors at play. Lakshman Achathan is co-founder of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. He says deliberate supply cuts by Russia and Saudi Arabia and turmoil in Venezuela have helped push up oil prices.
And when you look over at home prices, the rise has much to do with supply again. It's just fewer homes available for sale. And for a whole host of reasons, new construction just hasn't kept up.
Mickey Levy is chief economist with Berenberg Capital Markets. He says while consumer prices are creeping up at a pace of just above 2% a year,
the markets do not anticipate any dramatic increase in inflation. It's still low.
Even if higher prices reflect a stronger economy, there's a big problem if workers can't afford to pay more. And economist Ioana Marinescu at the University of Pennsylvania says wage growth has been sluggish.
A lot of the strength of the economy benefits employers and shareholders, and it does not necessarily benefit much, you know, the average worker.
Average wages are finally rising faster than inflation, but most of those gains are going to higher skilled workers. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, Amy ended right there on wages for skilled workers finally going up. The companies where a lot of those people work are doing better than fine, sitting on literally, in the figurative sense, mountains of cash. Google's parent company, Alphabet, $102 billion in the bank. We learned that yesterday. Apple, way more than double that. And it sounds like a good problem to have, right? Kind of is. But the big picture economic question is what companies, tech and otherwise, are doing with all that money. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath takes a look.
Stop me if this sounds familiar. Companies are sitting on big cash stockpiles, and they're showering it on their shareholders.
Who would have ever guessed that?
Lee Pinkowitz teaches finance at Georgetown.
If we believe that it is the shareholders' money, then it should be returned to them if corporations don't have any better use for it.
Of course, some people believe there are better uses for extra corporate cash, like investing it back in the company.
Expanding their plants, they could be hiring more workers, paying them more, and that money could filter through to the economy.
That's Ed Clissold of Ned Davis Research speaking on this program 3 years ago. I called him back today to see if anything's different.
The answers haven't changed much. I don't know if that makes you feel better or worse.
Tax cuts and cash coming back from overseas are filling up corporate coffers, he says.
And the most popular use of it to date seems to be more buybacks. In the first quarter, about $170 billion of new repurchases were announced by S&P 500 companies.
That's more than a third of last year's total, in just one quarter.
So this will most likely be easily a record year for buybacks.
The thing that would change that, he says, would be sustained economic growth, over 3.5% for several years, which would lead companies to invest more of their cash to keep up with demand. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
This is Europe Week in the White House. German Chancellor Angela Merkel shows up Friday. French President Emmanuel Macron is there now. Trade is right at the top of the agenda, those steel and aluminum tariffs, and how the European Union wants permanent exemptions from those import duties. China, as you might have heard, didn't get any exemptions, and it took its case to the World Trade Organization. And this week, the EU, in contrast to the negotiating that Macron and Merkel are doing at the White House, the EU decided to join that complaint, as have Russia, India, and others. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson tells us what all that means.
Consider it Plan B. The EU would really like the Trump administration to give it a once-and-for-all final exemption from these steel and aluminum tariffs, one that doesn't require the EU to offer up other concessions. Gregory Schaefer is a professor at the University of California, Irvine.
The EU is using this as leverage to try to get a permanent exemption from the United States for its tariffs on steel and aluminum.
But there are other reasons to go through the WTO. Litigating it this way will give the EU legal cover to impose tariffs of its own on U.S. products. It also wants to discourage other countries from trying something similar, using a national security argument to protect a domestic industry, says Robert Lawrence at the Harvard Kennedy School.
There's been an unwritten tradition in the WTO that countries should show restraint and that they shouldn't use this provision because it has the ability of undermining the rest of the agreement.
So by challenging these tariffs at the WTO, the EU and even the Chinese are taking pains to say the Americans are breaking the rules, but we are not. Edward Alden is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
If you look honestly at what's happening right now, this is not going to be resolved by the WTO. It's going to be resolved by direct negotiations with the countries involved.
But by running a complaint through the WTO, Alden says the EU is hoping to preserve its relevance and integrity for future disputes. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday? Ugly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We talked a little bit about oil up top and which way prices are going, which is up. Lay a little bit of supply and demand on top of that reality, and you quickly get to this, that there is going to be more oil coming on the market the higher that price gets. The International Energy Agency says the United States is going to pass Russia as the world's top oil producer by the end of this year. And a lot of that oil, and natural gas as well, comes from West Texas, the Permian Basin it's called, where output has tripled in the last 3 years. Times there are good right now, but oil prices go down too, you know. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the ups and the downs of life in the Permian oil field.
A 100-foot rig pushes up amid acres of irrigated cotton fields and long dirt roads. Oil derricks and pump jacks dot the horizon. If you can't see you're in oil country here, well, you ain't looking. I'm in an oil patch between the two big cities here, Midland and Odessa. Both have about 150,000 people. Tommy Taylor, the guy I'm meeting, seems to know most of them.
How we doing?
Taylor's the director of oil and gas development at Fasken Oil and Ranch. He's worked there for 33 years, and he jokes that the oil business isn't just on his resume. It's in his blood.
My dad was a petroleum engineer. My oldest brother's a petroleum engineer. My middle brother's a mechanical engineer. I mean, my sister's a school teacher, but she married a petroleum engineer. You know, it's just kind of in the family.
For families here, the price of oil makes the difference between hard times and high times. About 6 months ago, oil started creeping above $50 a barrel. 18 months earlier, it had been around half that. Taylor recalls that time when Fasken went down to operating just one rig and stopped hiring. The drillers and roughnecks drifted away, found jobs elsewhere. But times weren't just hard for those working in the oil industry. As they say in these parts, even if you're not in oil and gas, you're in oil and gas. Dustin Freeman, general manager of Katie's Barbecue in Midland, recalls his struggles when oil was in the doldrums.
We felt it when the company started taking away their salesmen's cards and what they could spend, because a lot of our business is these salesmen coming in, grabbing stuff, taking it out to rigs, taking it out to frac crews, and those almost ceased completely.
Freeman had to cut costs just so his restaurant could survive. But that wasn't easy when he had to buy another commodity with a rapidly fluctuating price, beef. The farmers didn't just drop their prices because oil prices were low. Freeman says now that oil prices have picked up again, everybody's happier.
You see it in their faces. You see it in how they talk to you, you know, and you see it in the traffic. Midland's a small town. The infrastructure is not here to support as many people are here. So, you know, oil's good when you start seeing the traffic getting bad.
Right now, traffic is awful as 18-wheelers ferry gear to and from the oil patch, stuck between workers' pickup trucks and moms taking their kids to school. The state wants to boost investment in what it calls public infrastructure and workforce development. That's easier said than done, says Diana Hinton. She teaches the history of the petroleum industry at the University of Texas Permian Basin. She's lived in the area since 1973.
We live in a town that's squarely tied to a very volatile industry. But you know, most of us really were pretty sore about the condition of the roads and the level of traffic. And, well, that's part of the picture.
Last year, oil taxes brought the state more than $2 billion in revenue. But none of that goes to fixing roads in the areas where there's production. Instead, the money is divided among several state funds. Midland County Judge Mike Bradford has a big say in what gets built. He argues too much of the money generated here goes to the state capital and isn't used to help locals. Midland, Odessa is consistently among the highest median household income areas in the nation, yet the public schools here are among the poorest performing in the state.
The school district has the hardest task. The state of Texas has continually cut school funding. They can't build schools tomorrow for the population they got now, and then when the market changes, hear yourself walk down that hall. They've got a lot more at stake.
The residents of Midland and Odessa have a lot at stake, too. When oil prices and production rise, local realtors, bar owners, and apartment complexes hike their prices. If you live here in the Permian and you're not getting the kind of wage bump that oil workers are currently enjoying, you could be out of luck. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There's more of Andy's reporting from the Permian Basin coming up tomorrow, bright and early, on the Marketplace Morning Report. A couple of Facebook items of note today. The company has released its full set of what are known as community standards, what's okay and what's not okay to post on that platform. Also, the Cambridge Analytica saga continues. Today, whistleblower Christopher Wiley appeared before House Democrats in a closed-door hearing looking into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. On balance, then, kind of a middling week, really, for the company in its efforts to reassure users that their data is going to be safe. You know who's not really all upset by this whole thing, though? Companies that advertise on Facebook. Sandra Upson's a senior editor at Wired Magazine. She wrote about Facebook and its ads economy not too long ago. Sandra, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
All kinds of bad press for this company the last, like, month or so, and yet the advertisers are hanging around. What's your sense? How come?
Well, it's been an interesting time. I called up a bunch of different agencies, mostly the digital ones, and wanted to see what kind of reaction they were getting from their clients. And at the end of the day, they still loved Facebook. It's just the best product by far for what they want.
Is that because it's the 2 billion customer gorilla, if you will, the 800-pound gorilla in this case?
I mean, it boils down to the data for sure. Yeah, they have 2 billion people. No one else has that kind of reach. And they can target their ads better than anybody else, even if you take away some of the specificity, even if you take the sharpness off of its, well, that's a bad metaphor. I'll stop that.
Well, no, I get it. No, I get it. Because here's the deal. Facebook is better at doing this, is better at slicing and dicing its customer base than anybody else. And that then lets advertisers get more advertising bang for their buck, as it were.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it is.
Okay, so what happens if, as Zuckerberg said on the Hill last week, they do eventually roll in the European data privacy requirements that are coming as part of GDPR? What does that do to the value of the data that Facebook has?
There are a lot of questions still about how the European data regulations are going to change the options available. But what I found really interesting in my conversations with these ad agencies was that their clients didn't actually care too much if the product became a little less good at its job, as long as everyone had the same opportunities. You know, they said, okay, well, if you're going to take a little bit of a hit, that's fine. They still had more reach than anybody else.
And also, I would imagine that the quality of the data they would get under some kind of European data regime might be of higher quality, right? Because in theory, people are abiding by what Facebook is doing with the data.
Yeah, well, one of the changes that they're rolling out is they are requiring advertisers to provide email addresses for their customers that they acquired legitimately, so that they acquired, you know, with those customers' permission. And a lot of the advertisers are actually kind of happy, or at least this is what they tell me, they're happy that that's happening, that we're going to be a more upright and, you know, we're embracing proper practices that maybe should have been in place all along. So they're not upset to be less, you know, icky.
Right, right. I was going to use the phrase above board, but that's perhaps a bit pejorative here, right? Yeah, yeah. Absent these European privacy regulations, which Facebook says it's going to abide by, what do you suppose, once Congress figures out how and whether it wants to regulate domestically these companies, what do you suppose that's going to do to advertising and to how advertisers view these platforms? Facebook, Google, Snapchat, take your pick.
Ultimately, digital advertising is where it is regardless. Advertisers might start putting in more effort into advanced email campaigns and loyalty programs where they try and find data from their customers in slightly different avenues. But at the end of the day, there's no change. We're going to go forward with this as it is. That's where the money is. That's where the users are. Right. Advertisers will just adapt and continue as they have been.
Sandra Upson, senior editor at Wired, talking about Facebook and its advertisers and why everything's still going the way it's going. Sandra, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up,
we were truly able to ride the speed limit at any time of the day.
Today, though, not so much. First, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. Dow Industrial's off 424 today, 1.75%, 24,024. NASDAQ down 121, 1.7%, 7,007. There's all kinds of palindromes in these numbers today, man. S&P 500 dropped 35 points, 1.33%. Oh, the S&P blew it, 26.34. Some healthy corporate earnings reports out today that still left the market sagging on fears the profit palooza is coming to an end. Alphabet, Google parent company, off 4.75%. Microsoft gave back 2.33%. Facebook off 3.7% today. Bonds we touched on. Yield did top 3%, but closed just a hair lower, 2.99%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is on a mission, one that's really all about you. Everything we do is aimed at making people smarter about the financial forces that govern our lives, encouraging civil discourse, and making better decisions for you and your family. And we've been doing it for almost 30 years, but we are always thinking bigger and better, and that's where we need your help. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across the country. Right now, your donation will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Candida. Time is running out on the challenge, so please become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount works for you at Marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. If you look at a timeline of the financial crisis, the month of April 2008 was pretty slow, relatively speaking. The Fed cut its short-term interest rate down to 2%, but otherwise nothing ginormous. The after effects, though, of that spring and summer and fall 10 years ago are still with us today. And they're what we're looking at this year in a project called Divided Decade, including how the lives of people all over this country were changed in ways big and small by the Great Recession. Today, from Silver Spring, Maryland, federal government employee Glennis Hill.
So the 2008 timeframe was kind of rough. That was almost like taking care of two households at the time, trying to pay for my father's nursing facility. So it was a pretty rough time. The biggest thing that I remember was the back and forth, whether it was a recession or actually a depression. Because when you really looked at it with banks failing, the news coverage was really covering it as if, oh, we're just in a bad recession. But there was a lot more for other people because it backed up my date of retirement. I know that much. So I'm feels like in denial right now. It's like, well, I can't retire when I thought I was going to, so I don't know when I'm going to retire. I watched my mother and my aunts, you know, budget and pay for things and work two jobs, especially my mother, to send me through school. Budgeting has changed somewhat because things have now increased in price. And I'm talking, you know, from everything from groceries to utilities. So definitely these spending habits have totally changed. You know, just because you have some expendable income doesn't mean you go out and spend it just then. You know, because you never know, working for the federal government, will it be closed down again?
We've got a picture of Glennis Hill on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, take a sec, let us know how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. To the surprise of absolutely nobody who lives here in Los Angeles, this city topped a recent list of the most congested cities in the world. We have no monopoly on bad traffic here, of course. It's a constant of urban life almost everywhere, along with complaints about it and the very real costs that too many cars bring. Turns out, though, that all that traffic is actually saying something about a city's development and its economic health. From KPCC here in Los Angeles, Megan McCarty-Carino has a history lesson.
There was a saying back in the day, you could get anywhere in Los Angeles in 20 minutes.
I heard it and I trusted it, at least in the first decade of driving that I did.
Michael Alexander grew up in L.A. In the summer of 1964, he was a newly minted teenage driver. The freeways had just been built, and there were a bunch of guys singing on the radio about how neat it was to drive around.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round.
I got a job as a clown in the city's traveling circus.
Seriously, that's real. Every week he performed at a different park, from the northern reaches of the San Fernando Valley south to the ports, and he drove from place to place in his parents' Nash Rambler in roughly 20 minutes.
We were truly able to ride the speed limit at any time of the day.
Now, if you live in L.A. or have been to L.A. or know anything about L.A., you know that 20-minute rule is a thing of the past, maybe multiply by four. Traffic analytics firm INRIX names L.A. traffic the worst in the world, citing the 100 hours a year drivers are stuck in it. INRIX estimates that cost the economy $19 billion last year in time, fuel, and expenses passed on to consumers. The story of how we went from getting around to getting stuck behind the wheel starts less than a mile from Alexander's home at one of the earliest freeways in the country.
You know, it's important to me for the same reason the ruins of Pompeii are important to a scholar of ancient Rome.
Matthew Roth is the historian for the Southern California Auto Club, and he took me on a tour of freeway history, starting with the Arroyo Seco Parkway from Pasadena to downtown, where we enter a tangled forest of curving ramps that opens into a vast, terrifying confluence of 12 lanes of traffic.
We are at the third level.
These concrete landscapes were pioneered here in the post-war years. From the mid-50s to the mid-60s, California built nearly 100 miles of freeway a year, a system that became a model for the rest of the country. But the freeway building boom didn't last long.
Almost as quickly as it began, there was this peak and then drop.
Brian Taylor is an urban planning professor at UCLA. He says by the 70s, funding had dried up and cities were pushing back against displacement and smog. The freeway frenzy came to an end, but its legacy can still be felt.
These facilities supported development very far from the city center and created an expectation that it's somehow normal or reasonable to travel very far.
Like Michael Alexander, driving 20 miles for his clown job in just 20 minutes. Taylor says that ease of movement was bound to be short-lived.
Cities exist because they push lots of activities together in a place. But when you push things together, things get crowded and slowed down.
Congestion, not free movement, is the natural state of thriving cities. Sorry, guys. Since the 1960s, L.A. has exploded, pushing more things closer together. Not just cars and people, but jobs and restaurants and artisanal kombucha bars. So even though Michael Alexander can't drive 20 miles in 20 minutes anymore, he doesn't necessarily have to. Before he retired, he worked 6 miles from home, and guess how long his commute was?
And I did have a 20-minute drive. That was a wonderful part of it.
Not everyone is so lucky, but wouldn't it be nice? In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Megan's story came to us from a statewide nonprofit media collaboration called California Dream. This final note on the way out today, which serves two purposes. One is to let me mention again, just real quick, the interview we did with Mick Mulvaney last week. He is the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You can catch up with it on our podcast, should you so choose. The other purpose served is to highlight once again the truism that branding matters. Apparently, Mr. Mulvaney, who's been a stickler to point out in our interview and others that he is following the letter of the law in his leadership of that agency, is extending that to the name of said agency. In common parlance, it is, as you know, the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Thing is, in the actual Dodd-Frank law in which it was created, it is called the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, and the agency is beginning to make that change official in its public dealings. So, say it out loud to yourself, both ways, see if it doesn't make a difference in how you perceive what it does. All right, we got to go. Wall Street today, just forget about it, all right? Digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.